Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today is James Farmer. I've known him for years as Jim. And he is the June Rainsford Henderson Chair in Southern and Local History Emeritus at the University of South Carolina, Aiken. And as I said, I've known Jim for years. We were in graduate school together. He's written, edited many books, but most recently, a book that fascinated me, An Edgefield Planter and His World, and it's the journals of Edgefield Planter Whitfield Brooks. Jim, welcome to the journal.
Thank you, Walter.
Let's talk a little bit, first of all, about you. Our listeners need to know a little bit more about you outside the Aiken world. So who are you? Who are your people? They already know you went to graduate school, but let's fill in some blanks.
Well, you're reminding me of when I met Strom Thurmond many years ago. I think it was on the courthouse steps in Edgefield, and a bunch of people were being introduced to him. And someone introduced me to him, and he said, "Who are your people?" And I said, "Senator Thurmond, my folks are all from North Carolina." And that diminished his interest in me somewhat. But I was born in eastern North Carolina, Wilson. Grew up there, went to East Carolina College. Majored in history, but got a B.S. rather than a B.A. because I wanted to teach public schools. So I got out in August and was looking for a job because I was engaged to be married in October. There was an opening in Florence, South Carolina, about which I knew almost nothing. I drove down, was offered the job on the spot, a bird in the hand, couldn't turn it down. So I taught 2 years in Florence, and during that time, I started thinking about the possibility of grad school. They let me come to Columbia for a summer session. I very, very well remember I learned all about what a terrible thing communism was and how we should integrate democratic values into public education. Anyway, I liked it well enough and did well enough that I stayed for the fall. And 2 years later, got my master's, went back and taught at East Carolina 1 year, filling in for someone, then back to Columbia, doctoral work. 1973, I got a job at USC Lancaster. Stayed there until 1991, and there was a new endowed chair had just been created at Aiken. A couple of big-name people had been offered it, and for whatever reason, that didn't work out, so they were down to my level, offered it to me, and I finished my career there. I retired in 2008.
All right. Remind me who you did your dissertation work with.
George Rogers directed my dissertation. Okay. Bless his heart. It evolved into a study of religious thought as well as political and social thought in the late antebellum period, focusing on James Henley Thornwell. George Rogers gave me just enough help and sort of allowed me a fairly long leash to do the dissertation. And I'm happy to say that when I finished it and shopped it around for publication, I found a press, the same one that did the book we're talking about today, that was willing to publish it with very few rewrites. And that came out in the mid-80s as a fancy title that some people have given me a hard time about, The Metaphysical Confederacy, trying to describe
the... Right, did you come up with that title or did the press?
I actually came up with that title when I was driving to lunch one day on the USC Lancaster campus trying to decide on it. And I knew it was pompous from the beginning, but it just seemed to capture what I was trying to do in the book.
But the title attracted attention, as did the book. And I know it's on a lot of bookshelves, particularly anybody who's studying the antebellum South. So pompous title or not, it works. That's the whole thing with a title. You grab people's attention. So let's talk about how you got into this project. The Brooks family, very important in Edgefield, South Carolina, and American history. But how did you get a hold of these journals? What's the story of the publication? Because that, I think, is a tale in itself.
Well, two of the Brooks descendants live in Greenwood, South Carolina. They are both elderly, Emmett Brooks and his sister, Mary Jane Brooks Mobley. She had two of the volumes of the Whitfield Brooks diary herself. I called it a diary. He called it a journal, so it's a journal in the book. There's not much difference, from what I can tell, between a journal and a diary. So Bettis Rainsford, I'm sure, was the one who told me initially about the Brooks journals and mentioned that he thought Mary Jane had them at her home. But that was Volume 1 and Volume 3, and there was a gap in the middle. So I thought, well, that's interesting. And actually, Bettis at some point had come into possession of a photocopy of the first and third volumes, and he had them in one of these huge three-ring binders. I took a look at that. This was in the mid-90s, I guess. And, of course, the first thing that occurred to me is this guy any connection with Preston Brooks, whose name is in every American history textbook, as a congressman from South Carolina who took his walking stick and beat Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts over the head until he fell unconscious on the floor. This was in 1856, about 5 years after the diary fellow died. So that was interesting. But the idea of publishing two disconnected volumes of a diary didn't seem to make a lot of sense, at least to me. And then some time passed, actually quite a few years. I'll give credit to Jane Aldrich, who worked at that time at the South Carolina Historical Society. She knew that I was interested in Edgefield. And one day, according to the story that she told me, someone walked in off the street and had with them a ragged volume, manuscript volume, covers gone, several of the pages sort of shredded. Said, I got this in a box that I bought at a yard sale or an estate sale, and I don't know if it's any use to y'all, but I don't need it, so would you like to have it? Long story short, it turned out that that was the middle volume, and she emailed me to tell me that. Not only that, they had a volunteer there who had transcribed that volume. And so I was interested enough to go down and spend a couple of days in Charleston. They let me actually see the manuscript, which they don't let anybody touch for good reason because it's so delicate, and to compare it to the transcription. And this woman had transcribed every page exactly as it was in the manuscript. And she had kept all the spelling, all the punctuation. Anyway, that convinced me that that transcription was a good job, and that now it was possible to put the three volumes together. So what I did was then to sit down with that photocopy of the first and third volumes, and I transcribed them onto my laptop using a voice recognition software for part of it. At that point, and she had sent me an electronic copy of what I call Volume 2, the middle volume.
Okay.
So I had on my computer my transcriptions and the volunteer in Charleston's of the entire journal. And I got really excited at that point. I had in the back of my mind maybe, and this was about the time I retired, so I had time on my hands, 2008, 2009. I had sort of a notion that a general history of Edgefield County was something that was needed and that maybe I should try to do that. I wasn't sure if I was going to live long enough to get it done, but talking about George Rogers, I well remembered his history of Georgetown County, which was something of a model to be wished for by any county. Dr. Rogers' history of Georgetown County convinced me that even an outstanding scholar could stoop down and do a local project. And so my chair at USC Aiken really obligated me to work in the area around Edgefield, Barnwell, perhaps maybe across the river in Richmond County, Georgia. But I guess I'll just be honest and say the county history was a bit daunting to me at that point in my life. As I say, I was retired, aware that I was kind of losing energy a little bit and not sure I had it in me to do a good job of a county history, especially one as rich as Edgefield's. Anyway, the Brooks Project got me more and more excited. Of course, while I'm doing the transcription, in the back of my mind is who would publish this? Is it really something that I can expect, especially a reputable press, to do? I decided to reach out to Mark Jolly at the Mercer University Press for one simple reason. They had published my book on Thornwell, we were mentioning a little while ago. religion is a strong theme with them, and that I'm sure was the reason why they were interested in my Thornhill biography. You could argue that religion is an important subplot in the diary or journal of Whitfield Brooks as well, although he was, of course, not a clergyman. But Mark said, we're going to go ahead with it. And so that solved all of my problems, except for the research that went into the footnotes, which is the reason the book was not out 4 or 5 years ago, frankly.
That's where, when I started going through your book, I was transported back a half century, because one of the things George Rogers said, it doesn't make any difference who's what papers are, it's Calhoun, Lawrence, Polk, read the footnotes. That's where the fun and the interesting things are. It's in the footnotes. And so if you'll just forgive me, what I did is I read footnotes. And I mean, they're wonderful. They're absolutely wonderful.
Well, let me put in a plug for Mercer in that regard, too. Most academic presses today put the notes in the back, and they're end notes. Mercer still does notes at the bottom of every page. Genuine footnotes.
You had mentioned earlier that you had at least considered writing an Edgefield County history. In your footnotes, in essence, you've written a 10-year history, a history of Edgefield County from 1840 to 1850. Did you realize that with your footnotes?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. And it's a lot easier to do a decade than 200 years. So there's that, too.
All right. Well, let's get into the book itself. First of all, who's Whitfield Brooks?
Whitfield Brooks was one of the folks whose ancestors had migrated down, in his case, from Virginia, through the Piedmont of North Carolina, settled there for a brief time, and then made their way on down, ultimately to what is now Newberry County. His grandfather had come down with his brother and their spouses and some other relatives. And then Whitfield's father was actually, whose name was Zachariah, was actually either born en route as they were moving down or soon after they arrived.
Is this before the Revolution?
Yes, it's before the Revolution. I'm sorry. Yes, this was in the 1760s.
Okay, that's
part of that Scotch-Irish, as we usually say, migration, although they were not Scotch-Irish.
Yeah, they picked up the Great Wagon Road and came down.
Right.
Okay.
Zachariah settled across the Saluda River from Edgefield in Newberry County. He was a volunteer in the Revolutionary War. He was only 16 when he volunteered. While we're on the subject of the Revolution, Zachariah's wife, whose name was Elizabeth, had a brother and a father who were prominent in the cause of independence in that area. They were both butlers. One was James, the other was William. And their service in the Revolutionary War elevated the name Butler and the Butler family to, if you will, backcountry aristocratic status, which continued down through most of the 19th century. The fact that Whitfield Brooks was kin to the Butlers was one of the reasons that his career took the trajectory that it did. So that's getting us down to, let's bring Whitfield onto the scene. He was born in 1790. His mother is going to die in 1802. He's the oldest of four children. The other three were girls. And during the first decade of his life, the family moves across the Saluda and settles in the northeastern portion of what was then the old Edgefield District, now in Saluda County. In fact, there's a Butler Methodist Church right outside of the town of Saluda, where a lot of those butlers that became very prominent during and after the Revolution are buried. It's a very impressive thing to walk around and see those tombstones with all those names, including, for example, Andrew Pickens Butler, mm-hmm. who took the verbal assault that Senator Sumner had launched that led to the caning by Preston Brooks. So family, generationally, is a part of the explanation for a lot of the things that go on in South Carolina history. Whitfield is born in 1790. grows up on the Edgefield County side, as I said. And his father, Zachariah, probably had virtually no formal education, but a lot of gumption, obviously, and a lot of ambition. He begins to acquire slaves, and again, the census comes in handy here. I think in the census of 1800, he already has 12 slaves.
So he was part of the first cotton boom.
Yes, and probably actually growing tobacco even before the cotton gin. The commercial cotton industry, of course, awaits the introduction of the cotton gin, so he switches to cotton, I'm sure, pretty quickly after that becomes feasible. So he's going to begin making some money, and as I mentioned in the introduction, the backcountry at that time was largely a cashless economy, but people like Zachariah Brooks were on the cutting edge of transforming it into more of a commercial economy and more upwardly mobile, profit-minded. And, of course, along with that goes the ownership of slaves. The number of slaves that Zachariah owned is at least in the teens by the early 1800s. So that's the environment that young Whitfield grows up in. He gets a better-than-average education. He is sent to Mount Bethel Academy back over in Newberry, and then enters the South Carolina College as a member of the junior class in 1810, graduates in 1812. The South Carolina College was not only the public institution of higher learning in the state, but it was a meeting ground for sons of upcountry and lowcountry citizens. A lot of friendships were formed there. A lot of marriages probably came out of young men meeting the sisters of their classmates, upcountry, lowcountry, and so forth.
As we know, that was one of the purposes of the founding of the South Carolina College.
Right. And it served it well.
Was to bring together the upcountry and the lowcountry, because right after the Revolution, it may be a little bit of an exaggeration, but some folks thought that the state might be on the verge of an internal civil war. There was so much contention between the two sections of the state.
Right.
And so bring the boys together, let them get to know each other, and create a united ruling elite.
Well, I'll drop three names, if I can recall them all here, who were young men that Whitfield became friends with on the campus in Columbia and remained friends with for most of the rest of his life. William Campbell Preston, later a U.S. Senator and president of South Carolina College. John Belton O'Neill, later a very well-known jurist.
Newberry.
Newberry. And then a fellow named Lewis Pinckney, who was the grandson of some of the famous Pinckneys of Lowcountry in the late 18th century, who becomes a U.S. congressman. I think may have been mayor of Charleston. I'm not sure. But anyway, those three men formed relationships with Whitfield Brooks. And at least in the case of the first two I mentioned, he remains in touch with them throughout the rest of his life.
Somewhere along the line, he does meet and marry a lowcountry heiress.
Right. Well, he finishes college in 1812, and he reads law in the office of Congressman Eldred Simpkins of Edgefield, mm-hmm. and passes the bar and begins to practice law. And then he is appointed, I guess would be the proper word, to fill a newly created position for Edgefield of Commissioner in Equity. The legislature had just, I guess, expanded that program, and it's a sort of a parallel track to the traditional courts that we know. It gives a rather extraordinary latitude to the commissioner to settle controversies, disputes among parties that, for whatever reason, would prefer not to go through the regular judicial process. And he held that job from, I think, 1816 to about 1832. He's still only about 26 years old when he is appointed to that. So I think that speaks well for his maturity and being a responsible young man.
And don't forget the person with whom he studied law, Simpkins.
Simpkins.
And his connections and the Butler family connection.
Right. And with that goes a connection to John C. Calhoun and Calhoun is mentioned a few times in the Brooks Journal. I think it's fair to say they knew each other. Actually, the one episode that comes up in the journal that involves Calhoun directly was the vacant congressional seat that Whitfield Brooks was considering running for. Calhoun is writing to his relative Francis W. Pickens, who was perhaps Whitfield Brooks' best friend, certainly one of his closest friends. And they're talking about who should be put forward to seek the congressional seat. And Calhoun mentions Whitfield Brooks, and he says, but I think he will concede or retire. I forget exactly the word he uses, but I think the implication is there, don't worry about Whitfield Brooks. I'll make sure that he will yield to whoever I give my blessing to, is the way, and sort of Calhoun living up to his image as the kingmaker of South Carolina politics. But how did I get off on that? You asked me about his Lowcountry wife. Let's back up. Well, her name was Mary Parsons Carroll. And the name Parsons shows up in South Carolina history during the period of the Revolution and right after, actually, right at the beginning, when South Carolina briefly has, under the Constitution of 1776, a president rather than a governor. And James Parsons was the vice president, or lieutenant governor, if you will, of South Carolina for a brief period. And I think his health made it necessary that he not hold the job very long. But an owner of vast number of acres of property, not only in the Lowcountry, but here's the main point, also in the backcountry. And it's known that the Parsons family came up and visited various areas of the upcountry while the patriarch was shopping for more land.
Parsons didn't have any children, did he?
He didn't have any children who survived him.
Okay.
Which is a crucial point, because in his will, and his estate was worth over £1 million. Now, the Carroll name, of course, comes in with the marriage of Mary's mother and father. She was a Parsons.
She was a niece of the...
She was a niece, right. Thank you. But she, I don't have any numbers, but obviously her side of the family is going to inherit a nice portion of that fortune that James Carroll Parsons left at his death. So she is a quote, Lowcountry heiress. And exactly where her path and Whitfield's crossed, I'm not sure, but I speculate that she may have come up to Edgefield for a visit during one of those trips to the backcountry. And this doesn't seem to be too much of a reach to me. Among the many pieces of land that Whitfield Brooks acquired was a tract called Mount Parsons. And I'll defer to Bettis Ransford's superior knowledge of real estate in Edgefield and say that in all probability, that tract came to Whitfield, if you will, through his marriage to Mary, that it was probably a piece of land that she inherited, and then it became legally his property after marriage.
Well, right after the Revolution, a lot of Lowcountry folks began to summer in the upcountry.
Mm-hmm.
So you may speculate, but I can easily see how, particularly with her uncle's property, that her family might have come with him anyway.
Right.
How they got together, in many ways, it's fun to speculate, but they did get together and married, and she brought to the marriage property.
Yes.
Considerable property.
Yes. And her mother moved to Edgefield not long after the marriage. Her name was Mary Giles Carroll, and her husband died, I'll just say, in the early 1820s. The marriage was in 1818. And so when she became widowed, she moved to Edgefield and lived right next door to her daughter and son-in-law, Whitfield and Mary, bringing with her her then 9-year-old son, James Parsons Carroll, who grows up as a protege of Whitfield, studies law with him, becomes an attorney, eventually ends his life living in Columbia as one of the most prominent members of the Columbia Bar. And something that I learned not too terribly long ago about him He, I believe, co-authored the report that was written when the city officials of Columbia authorized a study to be done of the causes of the fire that swept through Columbia in February of 1865. So that speaks well for the status that he had as a responsible citizen in Columbia.
Well, Jim, we need to pause again for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Jim Farmer about his book, An Edgefield Planter in His World, and it's about Whitfield Brooks of Edgefield District and all of the family connections, which is so much an integral part of South Carolina history. Let's spend the rest of the time, Jim, talking about Whitfield Brooks and what he puts in his journal about events, and especially what does he have to say about his son, Preston Brooks, who is the most famous member of the family.
Okay. The three volumes that are in this book begin in November of 1840, and they end in May of 1849. Preston was born in 1819, so he's just into his early 20s when the journal begins, and the journal covers the decade of his 20s. He will be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1852, so he is in his second term, toward the end of his second term, in that when that famous and notorious event occurs, the caning in May of 1856. So we get to follow Preston's maturing through his 20s during the course of the journal. He's the oldest son. There are three other boys and one daughter, that are born to Whitfield and Mary.
He's the oldest son, but he doesn't seem to be the favored son.
Well, this is an interesting question. I've had conversations with various people who know enough about the Brookses for me to certainly respect their opinion about whether I'm reading maybe a little more into some of the things that Whitfield says than is warranted. And I think of myself as a pretty cautious researcher and writer. But now that historians have sort of given themselves permission to speculate a little more than perhaps we used to, you referred to me earlier as someone who writes history more in an old-fashioned way, and I don't object to that at all. But there are places in the journal where Brooks comes right out and in effect says, I'm a little disappointed in the boy at this point. I would have thought that he was a little more mature than the way he's behaving. I am not referring to the feud which rose to the level of a duel that young Preston Brooks got involved in with a man named Lewis Wigfall, who is one of the larger-than-life, swashbuckling sort of characters that we find in Southern history, not only South Carolina, but in his case, all the way over to Texas.
Well, that's because he went belly up in South Carolina. He went to Texas.
Right, yeah.
All those folks went to Texas. A lot of times they were one step ahead of the law. And in fact, some of these kinfolk like Bonham doesn't have the greatest reputation when he gets to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he kept a journal, too.
But yeah.
So well, anyway, Mr. Wigfall is a great character.
Yeah.
But it's local politics in terms of
yes.
a family feud. This is almost a Hatfield-McCoy situation.
Yes. Well, I think it's certainly interesting and fortuitous, I guess, for my purposes, that the opening episode that Whitfield Brooks writes about in the first volume is this affair— not in the modern sense, but in the earlier sense, between his son Preston, well, actually between the Brooks family. I'm remembering now John Edmonds, who wrote the biography of Francis Pickens a generation or so ago, refers to the Edgefield Junto, a sort of a cabal of politicians of which Whitfield and his family were a member.
And the Pickenses were not.
The Pickenses were not. And there's some back and forth that sort of goes on there. There's another character whose name comes up. Francis Hugh Wardlaw, who at one time was a law partner of Whitfield Brooks, is a sometimes ally of that group and other times outside of. And, of course, if you've got political ambitions, you have to, I suppose, be flexible enough to see an opportunity that you may have to sort of step on a few friends' toes in order to get that sort of thing. But let's try to go back to Preston. Whitfield actually witnesses the shooting, that an exchange of gunfire that occurred between his son and Lewis Wigfall on an island called Goat Island in the Savannah River. Typical kind of situation where you try to find a place where the jurisdiction is not entirely clear and you're not likely to be prosecuted for actually committing the crime. It was a crime in South Carolina to engage in a duel. Whitfield watches it, and within the first two or three pages of the journal, we read his reaction, where he says something to the effect that my feelings at that moment can be better appreciated than described, or words to that effect. Preston might well have died there. I mean, they had to row both of the seriously wounded men back across the river to the South Carolina side, took them to Hamburg, where they were patched up, and Preston was about 3 months in recovering. Both, of course, men did recover. The feud, by the way, continues. I think normally you at least hope that an exchange of gunfire will clear the air. Both men have established their courage and their honor, and that hopefully will end it. It did not in this case. It went on, and eventually, a year or more later, several of the big names in South Carolina had to be brought together as a court of honor. Wade Hampton, for example, not the general, but his father, were involved in using their prestige, basically their social position, to try to impose a reconciliation on terms that both parties would accept.
They actually had this up at Glen Springs, right?
Right. Or Limestone Springs. It may have been Limestone.
Well, one of the resort springs,
right,
upstate.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the father and son relationship. I think it's important to say that Whitfield did not condemn his son, apparently did not try to talk him out of the duel. It was something that at a certain point becomes necessary if you're to be thought of as a man, as a person of courage and whose honor is his most important possession. And, of course, he was greatly relieved that Preston survived. The disappointment comes in a little later, even after Preston has gotten married, when you normally expect a young man to settle down and begin to behave responsibly. Preston is not taking those responsibilities as seriously as his father thinks he should. He seems to be a young man who has sort of dreams, visions, imagines himself achieving great things, but without the fundamental sort of common sense, practical understanding that to get to where you want to go in that regard, you've got to earn your way. One morning in particular, Whitfield goes over to visit his son and his wife at his nearby plantation and finds that they're still in bed asleep. And he mentions that in the diary. You know, what am I going to do with this boy? He's a planter now. I've given him some slaves. I've helped him get started. And here he is still acting like an immature teenager.
Well, and then there's what Preston Brooks did or did not do during the Mexican War.
Right.
As compared to his younger brother, Whitfield.
Well, you mentioned the question of whether Preston was his father's favorite son or not. My argument is that the favorite was the third son, his namesake, Whitfield Butler Brooks. The middle son in between, or the son between the two, was James Carroll Brooks. He gets married and moves to Barnwell County and Barnwell District and has a farm there. Eventually moves back to Edgefield, but during most of the period of this journal, he's down there in Barnwell, so we don't see him mentioned that much. But the next brother, the third brother, Whitfield, is, I really think, the apple of his father's eye. He never mentions him that he doesn't say something positive about him. When he is still a teenager, young Whitfield is given the reins of a wagon with mules and told to tow the cotton bales to market in Hamburg, to negotiate, to sell the cotton, to bring the money back. And he does it and does it well. Interesting that Preston is not mentioned in the journal doing that, but then Preston is married, Whitfield is not, so perhaps that had something to do with it. But you can just—I don't think it's too much reading between the lines to say that you get a feeling whenever Whitfield is talking about his namesake that there's a bond there that takes precedence over relations with Preston. And then the question becomes, is Preston aware of this? Does it bother him? Does it trouble him? Does it place some kind of a burden on him to earn the respect and maybe even the love that he sees conveyed to his younger brother and feels is not conveyed to him?
And of course, during the Mexican War, young Whitfield, who's not married, is killed.
Right.
A hero.
Right.
Preston gets shipped back home before the battles with typhoid, right?
Right.
And he does go back, but there's a lot of local talk about, well, what did Preston really do during the war?
Yep. Well, the thing that must have hurt Preston more than anything else is that when they had the celebration for the returning members of the Palmetto Regiment, which I think we ought to note were the minority, more men whose bodies were left in Mexico or had to be carried home as corpses than marched back. Of course, disease had a lot to do with that as well as bullets. But Preston is still limping noticeably and walking with a cane as on the march in from Veracruz on the coast as they're headed across Mexico toward the capital, Mexico City. Of course, that's the ultimate objective. And the Palmetto Regiment is, I think, still acknowledged as the unit that arrived at the walls of Mexico City first and took the brunt of the first assault there. But Preston does come down with typhoid. Certainly the march could not have been good for him.
And he's still limping. That's the result
of the wound. He is still limping from the bullet that he took in the hip.
And it was never removed, right?
I believe that's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Footnotes are wonderful. I was digressing. Okay.
Well, the page in the journal where Whitfield describes getting the news of his son Whitfield's death, it was reported to him as he's walking on the streets of Edgefield. A young man comes up to him and basically says, your boy is dead. He was wounded and lived for about 6 weeks or more or less. And so a letter had come, maybe multiple letters. Whitfield knew that his son was in dire straits, but still had hopes that he would recover. He actually gets a letter that is dictated by young Whitfield to his commander, and he assures his father that his commander has said, you were heroic in this last assault. I could not have asked for a braver soldier than you. And in fact, at one point, he actually, I think, says, dear boy, you must not die. It really is a poignant scene to picture that on the battlefield. Now, Preston was not there to witness that, but he has lost his young brother in a heroic death, which all young men of that generation, of that class at least, wanted. It was denied to him. As you said, he becomes sick. He comes back home, and he is assigned the job of recruiting more men into the army. in the upcountry, because the manpower of the Army is beginning to shrink, as it often does in an all-volunteer force, when people begin to hear that it's not all that pleasant down in Mexico. He doesn't have a lot of success with recruiting. I guess all the willing men had already volunteered at this point. But he is desperately eager to get back down there and to have a chance to experience combat and to prove himself worthy in his father's eyes, as his younger brother has already done. They pull every string they can. His father writes to their congressman. Preston gives a kind of a deposition in which he explains that he had no choice but to come home. In fact, he wished he would have stayed, but his commander said, "No, you must go home and recuperate." So with that pull, a special request comes from Congressman Black, and he is sent back to Mexico, but too late to be in any of the important engagements. And he comes home, as you mentioned, with something of a cloud over his head. And he most pointedly was not given a commemorative sword, which was given to quite a few other veterans of the Palmetto Regiment. I imagine that the committee that was deciding who gets one and who doesn't looked at his record or talked to some of his fellow members of the regiment, and if they were candid, they had to say, well, you know, he was not in the thick of the battle. You know how that must have hurt young Preston. All this is sort of a long way around of saying that in 1856, when Sumner makes that notorious anti-slavery speech in which he singles out Senator Butler from South Carolina in particular, Preston Brooks...
Well, let's talk about some of the things that Sumner said about Senator Butler. They were cruel, personal comments.
Yes.
I mean, not just talking about slavery, but about the way he spoke and that sort of thing.
Well, this was a speech that Sumner had carefully written out and practiced in front of a mirror and pretty well memorized, and it was actually given over 2 days, so it took several hours. And as so often happens when a prominent senator is known to be preparing to make a speech, the galleries are full, and it was one of those classic scenes like when Calhoun or Webster or Clay would take the floor. It was an unprecedented speech, according to everyone who heard it. People like Stephen Douglas, future presidential nominee, said that damn fool is going to get himself shot if he doesn't shut up. And in fact, in that time, it was rumored at least that some members of Congress were going armed. But the speech itself was Sumner at his best, if you want to put it that way. He was a brilliant man, highly educated, spoke several languages, et cetera. But I think it'd be fair to say quite vain and quite self-centered, and he knew that this was his moment, that he would make his name in American history with this speech. It was called The Crime Against Kansas, and it focused, at least to begin with, on the violence between pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers in what was then the territory of Kansas, in which the future of slavery was still up in the air at that time. And then he goes on into basically a line of argument which says that slave owning itself is the root of all of this, because to own slaves turns a man into a tyrant, into almost a beast. He cannot dominate his slaves the way it is necessary to do and then shift gears and become a compliant, gentlemanly, open-minded member of society. He carries that slave owner's personality with him. In the course of all this, he steps across a line, a sort of an understanding that senators are not going to speak ill of another member of that august body, who, by the way, happened not even to be present at the time because he was ill. Senator Butler is going to die within the next year, as, by the way, Preston Brooks will die within the next year. But you mentioned the reference to his speech. Butler had had at least one stroke, and as a result of that, his speech was not fully controlled. He could not control the movements of his lips and tongue quite adequately, and he would perhaps spit a little bit as he was speaking. This was obviously something that anybody in the Senate would have been familiar with, but no one had mentioned it, certainly not in a formal speech. But there's a line in there. First of all, he's already referred to Butler as the Sancho Panza.
When he talks about his mistress.
Oh, yeah.
The harlot slavery.
Right. Well, and that is a reference to Don Quixote, the famous Spanish novel, The Man of La Mancha. And Don Quixote, of course, is a character who is, as I say, tilting at windmills. He's an idealist who lives in a fantasy world in which he imagines himself as a medieval knight with his squire, sidekick, Sancho Panza. So he's a comedic figure, kind of a ridiculous figure. And Sumner is using that as a comparison with these pro-slavery senators in general and Senator Butler in particular. Now, Brooks was not present. Brooks was in the House of Representatives, not the Senate. A lot of accounts of this call him Senator Brooks. He was a congressman. And he heard about the speech. And to his credit, he asked for a copy of it so he could read it carefully and be sure that what was alleged to have been said was actually said and so forth. And he was enraged, as any South Carolina white person would have been, certainly a slave owner who felt that he was being attacked along with Senator Butler. He spent a couple of days mulling over what he should do about it. He was egged on, I think it'd be fair to say, by his friend Lawrence Kite. And whether he would have gone through with the caning without Kite's encouragement is an interesting question. But I like to imagine, to sort of complete the scenario here, that this is unfinished business in Brooks's mind because of the disappointment that he was to his father and his inability to rectify that on the battlefield in Mexico. Daddy is gone now, but if he's looking down, surely this will make up for whatever inadequacies I had.
Well, and you're getting into the whole notion of family honor. Senator Butler, I believe, is actually Preston Brooks' first cousin once removed.
Exactly.
So it's very close. To white Southerners, members of the Southern elite, whether it's South Carolina, anywhere, this defense of family honor was perfectly understandable.
Yes, and was lauded by most Southern newspapers, as it was, of course, roundly condemned by most, if not all, Northern newspapers. Sumner was made into a martyr, a figurative martyr. He didn't die from the caning, although he was for about 3 years, I believe, recuperating and not in his seat in the Senate. But he became, I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said something to the effect that Brooks's cane, he made a reference to the cross of Jesus, as if Sumner was a martyr comparable to the Savior, which is a bit hyperbolic. But the culture of honor, the code of honor, which was certainly well enough understood by Southern men, at least of a certain class, and even below that class, there was a notion that they understood what it meant. They might not go through the ridiculous ritual of a duel. They would settle matters in other ways. But whatever shock the first hearing of this news of the caning might have created, the aftermath was, well, after all, you have to understand what he had endured secondhand, listening to or reading the speech and what was said about his cousin.
And he used the cane because he did not consider Sumner a gentleman. Therefore, there was no challenge to a duel.
Right.
And Jim, sadly, we're running out of time. So any last words for our listeners about Whitfield Brooks and the journal and what you hope people get out of it?
Well, I imagine that, first of all, people who are interested in Edgefield will find this book fascinating. People who are interested in the Southern Code of Honor and the culture that produced the kind of behavior we've been talking about now, I think will find it fascinating and enlightening. People who are interested in the juxtaposition of religion and honor and the sort of complicated tension that might exist between the Prince of Peace versus the culture which demands demonstrations of courage and honor. All this pervades this book. All of that is, it's hardly a day goes by that he doesn't make an entry, and you follow the course of his life almost without a beat. I think there is a one-month period in there where he's too sick to write. But all of this is available there, and personally, I think there's no better way to try to get into the mindset of a person like Brooks and of his culture and his time than to go to the source and read in his own words.
Well, I could not agree more. Thank you for being with us today on The Journal.
I've enjoyed it very much.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. I've known Jim Farmer for a long time, and his work in Southern and South Carolina history is very impressive. In the best sense, his editing style and his introduction are old-fashioned history. It tells a story, and when you read his editing of the journal, look at the footnotes, folks. That in itself is a 10-year history of Edgefield County. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.